Good morning. It is a Thursday, and that means it is time for Perspectives on WFSU-FM. Hi, I'm Tom Flanagan. Good to have you at the other end of the radio waves and the telephone lines and the internet connection and all these other ways we have to communicate with one another today. By the way, if you want to communicate by phone, the number here locally is 414-1234. If it's long distance from you to Florida's capital city, the number is 800-926-8809. And we have an email address. perspectives@wfsu.org. You can also join the conversation via Twitter, which is at WFSU Perspective. Well, I had in our little run-up to this program today mentioned at the outset that stroke, which is what we're going to talk about today, is the number three killer in the United States. I stand corrected. The latest data indicates that stroke is now the fourth leading cause of death in the nation, which means, simply enough, it is no longer quite as fatal as it used to be, nor is it quite as devastating when it comes to permanent, lifelong disability as it used to be. Most of us can remember when the word stroke was one of the most feared words in the English language. It's still a problem, but not as much as it was. So let's go around the table and meet some folks who can tell us about strokes today and how to prevent them and treat them and recover from them. First off, I'd like to say hi to a gentleman who knows a lot about strokes because he had one, Doug Wright. Doug, thanks for coming in, and we look forward to you sharing your story with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Tom.
We also welcome Perspectives Pro here, Cherie Porter. She is with the Rehabilitation Center at Tallahassee Memorial Healthcare. And good to see you, Cherie.
You too, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Okay. Also, another seasoned veteran here, Vaughn Knight, registered nurse, also from Tallahassee Memorial Healthcare, who works with stroke patients and gets them back on the road to recovery. Good to see you again, Vaughn.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And we welcome a newcomer to the staff over at TMH, Dr. Sagal, who is a neurologist, and you get to work with these folks also.
Yes, I do. I'm the stroke neurologist at Tallahassee Memorial Hospital.
Okay. And you came, what, about a year ago, doctor?
I've been here since July of 2012.
Okay. Before we get into anything else, what exactly is a stroke?
A stroke is when a part of the brain does not get enough blood supply because of a blockage in the blood vessel. That is the most common type of stroke when we say the word stroke. There are certain strokes which are because of rupture of the blood vessel in the brain, which cause bleeding in the brain. Those are the two major types of strokes, and we call it ischemic stroke, where there is lack of blood supply, and hemorrhagic stroke, where there is bleeding in the brain.
Okay. But in either case, the results can be devastating if not taken care of quickly.
Yes. Especially the ischemic stroke, if the patients are able to come to the hospital in time, they can receive treatments which are approved by the FDA to help with reduction in disability and reduction in the mortality rates.
Okay. That's the medical look at it. Let's get the personal thing. Doug Wright, you had a stroke. What happened? Tell us that story.
Okay, well, I have for years been a regular exerciser. I would typically go to the gym 3 days a week for several hours of workout. And one day I went through my normal routine, and near the end of the routine, I just collapsed on one of the machines. I was doing an aerobic exercise on the elliptical machine, and I was at Premier Health and Fitness Center, where I'd been going, I guess, since they opened many years ago. Anyway, I think one of the most important things for me was that I was in the right place when I had a stroke. Those people are trained to recognize that somebody's in distress and get them help quickly. And Lynn Harvey and his team at Premier recognized right away that I was in a severe problem, and they called 911 and also unwound me from the machine and got me on the floor or in a chair. I don't remember any of that, so I'm not sure exactly how that worked. But I know that I found out later that from the time they spotted me collapsing on the machine, 27 minutes later, I was in the emergency room at TMH. And I have been told and read many times the importance of time as regards a stroke, getting help as quickly as you can. And they certainly did a good job of that at Premier, and also the EMTs and then the people in the emergency room and Dr. Sagal and his team. And so here I sit today, maybe 5 months later, and I still have some residual effects. My fingers on my right hand don't work properly. I can use the hand, but the fingers don't work very well independently. And you might be able to tell my speech is still affected. The little small muscles in my cheek, apparently I still have some paralysis there, so my speech has been affected. But other than that, health-wise, I'm in as good a health as I was before the stroke. And that again, is because of the help I've gotten with TMH. I mean, they got me into a rehab facility straight out of the hospital. And then I tried to go back and exercise again and found out I didn't have the strength to do it. And they referred me to TMH's new cardiac pulmonary rehab center right on the same grounds as the hospital. And I was there 2 months with Mark Louie and his team. And that was just phenomenal. Again, I was going 3 days a week, and that routine was 3 hours.
Wow.
And I finally graduated from that and went back to Premier, and I'm doing a very strenuous exercise routine. I'm enjoying it. I feel like it's keeping me in good shape, and I'm very thankful to be here today with as few residual of effects as I have.
Well, it really surprised me when you came into the station and Cherie and Dr. Sagal and Vaughn brought you in. I never would have known. Absolutely, had you not told me right now what some of the residuals were. I can't tell. And so, Cherie Porter, good prognosis here for someone like Doug here.
Well, Doug is actually very much like the members we have in our stroke wellness group at the rehab center at TMH. As you know, you've met some of them before. There's a lively group. And these are people who have experienced a stroke. We call these people stroke survivors. And they come in every Monday for a couple of hours. The first hour they sit round table and they talk about things that they're facing out in the community. And Becky Greenhill and Ginger Deason, two of our speech-language pathologists, run that group. And then just after that, we go into the gym at the rehab center and exercise for an hour with Ray Ramon, who leads them in exercise. And the point is Doug is correct, getting back out into life again. His attitude is carrying him through. And we see the same thing at the rehab center with our stroke survivors in the group, of having that great attitude. There's a cheesy saying that I use: if you practice the ABCs of success, which stand for attitude, belief, and commitment, who knows how far you'll go. And Doug is a good example of that, just as the members of our group.
And Vaughn Knight is doing day-to-day care for folks like this. Is it a matter of just kind of retraining yourself or, kind of rebuilding from the inside out? How does all this happen?
Absolutely. Doug, I see a lot of patients come in, their families, and one of my major roles as stroke coordinator is to provide the education to them. And what we focus on is teaching them about their personal risk factors for stroke. And while Tallahassee Memorial Healthcare is world-class in the treatment for acute stroke, but the biggest message we want to get out to the public, the best treatment for stroke, is preventing strokes.
That's and always the cheapest way to kind of take care of the situation too,
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Okay. I want to talk about the ways to prevent stroke in just a moment. But first, getting back to Dr. Sago and that the rapidity of response, how important is that? As Doug said, within 27 minutes from the collapse on the elliptical machine over Premier Fitness to the emergency room door, less than half an hour.
Yes. And like Doug said, that he was at the right place at the right time. But unfortunately, most of our patients are not. And what is important is for everyone to recognize what the stroke symptoms are. And that is the main problem that we face for most of those stroke patients who come to the hospital too late. The reason is because they think, well, it may be something else. They may have pinched a nerve. They may have slept wrong. It may be that they're tired and they just ignore the symptoms. So that's why the way I like to describe it to the patients is we call it a stroke because it strikes you. And it will strike you with an abrupt symptom that can be an abrupt onset of facial weakness, abrupt onset of speech disturbance, abrupt onset of arm or leg weakness or numbness, abrupt onset of vision problem, or abrupt onset of trouble with your walking. And the way the American Stroke Association educates patients about this is by using the acronym FAST. And what FAST stands for is face, arm, speech, and time. So if there's anything wrong with face, arm, or speech, which is abrupt, which is the more important word here, anything that is sudden in onset involving your face, arm, or your speech, and by arm we mean arm and leg, that could be a potential stroke. And T is for time. Time is of the essence, and you absolutely have to call 911 immediately. A lot of times patients either would call their family members or would call their primary doctors or would call the emergency room. That just delays things. And the fastest way to get to the hospital so that you can get treatments is to call 911.
Because in Doug's case, I mean, it was a collapse. There was no mistaking. He was in deep distress. Something was very wrong. But for these other things, as you I think all of us have woken up in the morning think, oh, boy, I did something weird with his arm. And you don't want to overreact and, you know, call an ambulance and go to the ER. And they say, well, you slept wrong on your arm, dummy. Get out of here. You know, you've blown the whole day in the ER. And people may be afraid of that.
That's true. But if you have a sudden onset of symptom in an arm or leg, sudden onset of vision problems, or a sudden onset of speech problem or walking problem, that could be a stroke. And it's okay if you are overreading it. It's better to overread than miss a stroke because that would be a life-changing event.
And we'll be right back with more on Perspectives. Don't go away. Now, how many of us have said, you know, kind of in light, we're just funning around, you know, oh, this is going to give me a stroke, whether it's my job or, you know, the antics of a family member or something like that, and we kind of laugh it off. But strokes are serious business, and that's what we're talking about here on Perspectives today. Your input, too, at 414-1234. Have you had a stroke? Or do you know someone who has a friend, a family member, and you want to share that experience? Now would be a good time to do it, to try to let some more folks know exactly how they can prevent that from happening to them. Long distance is 800-926-8809. Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email address again. Back to you, Dr. Sago, on exactly what happened to Doug Wright, who's here with us, who had had a stroke. And you said that a stroke is an interruption of blood flow to the brain.
That's correct.
And he came into the ER. You got a hold of him. What was the situation there from the medical aspect?
So when he came to the emergency room, luckily he was able to get to the emergency room within about 30 minutes from when the symptoms started. And we have a clot busting medicine, which is FDA approved to be given to stroke patients within the first 3 hours if it is a blockage type of stroke. He received that TPA medicine, but he also got further treatments where we were able to go into the blood vessel and take that blood clot out. So that's how we restored blood supply to that part of the brain. But if we are too late in doing that, you may be able to take the blood clot out by doing those treatments, but it may have left enough brain injury already that the patient may not recover completely from that stroke. And that is why it is important to initiate treatments in time, because we know that if we initiate those treatments after 4 or 6 hours from the onset of symptoms, those patients do not benefit from those treatments. And in case of Doug, he was exercising when this happened. I would like to say that it wasn't the exercise that caused that stroke. I think sometimes that may become a misconception that he was exercising and that's why he had the stroke. Exercise actually is better for preventing a stroke as well as recovering from a stroke after you've had a stroke. In his case, and which is the case for some patients that we see in the hospital with strokes, he was on an aspirin regimen, which he was on since he had a heart attack several years ago. And that aspirin had to be stopped for a routine surgery procedure because there is a high risk of bleeding if you are on aspirin. But what happens is, one, if you stop, aspirin is stabilizing that plaque that is developing in your blood vessels, and it's also preventing small platelet clots to form in your blood vessels, which would obstruct blood flow and cause a stroke. When you stop the aspirin, those platelets are not getting inhibited by that aspirin anymore, and you have a higher risk of developing those blood clots. And also what we know from recent research is that it not actually is just the lack of aspirin. Actually, if you were on a blood thinner for a while and if you stop it, there is actually a rebound phenomenon where your blood becomes thicker than what it was even before you started taking aspirin. So stopping these medicines may not be such a safe thing to do if you're undergoing a routine procedure where you may be at risk for slightly more bleeding, but that risk would be smaller as compared to the risk of having a stroke if that aspirin was stopped. Granted, there are certain situations where you absolutely have to stop it if you're going to undergo a major surgery. But for minor surgeries, we should look at it on a case-by-case basis whether we should really stop that patient's blood thinner before doing that procedure.
Okay, because Doug, right, did you get that in the, I guess, run out from your incident? There are folks saying, oh boy, why, you know, you were working out real hard there, and that's why I don't exercise, because I don't want to have a stroke like you.
I did. I had a number of people that interpreted, especially after I appeared on television in an ad for the new rehab facility, and also there was a newspaper article, and I had a number of people, friends of mine and acquaintances, that would come up and say, boy, have you learned your lesson now? Have you quit exercising? It causes strokes. And I've tried my best to get the point across. It's just the opposite. No, I did not have a stroke because I was exercising. And I'm continuing to exercise. I'm back to the point now of where I was before I had the stroke. Very good exercise routine, and it's keeping me healthy. And I've had a number of doctors and rehab therapists that have told me that if I had not been exercising as faithfully as I had before I had that stroke, there's no way I would be back to where I am today. It was because of that exercise and having a, you know, a healthy body when I had the stroke. That's what helped me recover to the point I did.
And Sherry Porter, that continual exercise, a very critical part of the rehabilitative therapy too.
Oh, absolutely. And we hit it hard right from the day that you arrive at the rehab center at TMH. You might be admitted 3 days to our center after you've had a stroke, and we're going to, as soon as we can, get you on the bikes and at the parallel bars and doing those exercises. We're promoting that. And then going forward through the outpatient continuum and into the wellness regime after that, it's a big part of it. Like I said, in February, our stroke wellness group, they walked the entire 3.1 miles for the heart walk and did it all, you know, after they've had strokes. And they'll be the first to tell you the importance of exercise.
Back to you, Vaughn, because you mentioned the prevention part of the whole equation, not having a stroke to begin with, and how that is always preferable to how do you recover once you have had one. What are some of those risk factors you were talking about?
Well, Tom, some of the risk factors for stroke, we have modifiable risk factors, and that's high blood pressure, people with diabetes, people with high cholesterol, people that have atrial fibrillation, that's a regular heartbeat, people that smoke, people that drink excessive alcohol, and people that usually that are physically inactive. And when patients come in, we focus and we strive hard to personalize their stroke education, because we want them to know what causes stroke, my personal risk factor, whether it's I'm overweight, I smoke, and I have high blood pressure. And I would tell you the number one reason that people have stroke is uncontrolled high blood pressure. And little did I know before I got into the world of stroke, you know, I too halfway assumed that you, when you had a stroke, you were 80, 90, 95. But we have people in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s having massive strokes. So we really want to get the word out, education, education. And here again, the biggest piece of that is preventing strokes. So if I come in and I'm educated on my risk factor, hopefully I'm not coming back with stroke number two, stroke number three.
But the best thing is not have stroke number
not have
one.
Not have stroke number one, absolutely.
To the phones we go, which, by the way, 414-1234, 800-926-8809. Elizabeth joins us. Hey, Elizabeth.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a quick question. My father had a stroke in November and is still numb on the left side of his body. We were fortunate in that he didn't lose his speech or memory. But along with the numbness, he complains of constantly being cold on the left side of his body. Is there anything that we can do to help him with this?
Okay. Dr. Segal, what do you think?
It sounds like your father had a stroke, Elizabeth, in the sensory part of the brain, which controls all the sensations on the left side of the body. Usually, physical therapy or exercises would not help for that abnormal sensation, because that is coming because of that part of the brain being irritated. And there are certain medications that are available for relief from that symptom. And your father can discuss with your physician or your neurologist about those medicines.
So it's not really that he's experiencing cold on one side of the body. It's that the brain thinks it's cold.
That's correct, because the sensory relay center of the brain is injured, and it is making abnormal sensations when there is no abnormal sensation.
Okay. Are there any other tricks that a brain that has undergone stroke can play on someone in post-stroke?
Yes. For example, if people who have a right-sided stroke, so most right-handed people have the left side of the brain being dominant in terms of their language and right-handedness. If you have a stroke on the non-dominant side of the brain, sometimes you can have symptoms where you do not realize that you've had a stroke on the left side of the body. You ignore that left side of the body. If you show those patients their left hand, they may not recognize that it's their own left hand. And that is because of that part of the brain being injured, which helps us recognize our own body parts, and that part of the brain is injured.
Okay. Doug Wright, when you were recovering from your stroke there, you had mentioned a little bit of speech difficulty, weakness when you tried to go back to exercise again. What other challenges did you have to deal with?
I guess the one that affected me the most was the ability to swallow, which, you know, involves the same muscles that are still giving me some problems with speech. I think one side of my tongue was paralyzed. And there was some paralysis in the small muscles in my cheeks, my cheek and my throat, and I had a lot of difficulty swallowing. So I spent well over a month, I could not have a glass of water. That was very difficult. I had to, everything I drank had to be thickened fluids. The food I ate had to be chopped up very finely. But with time, that has gone away. Time and a good bit of speech therapy. And I finally got to the point where I could swallow better, and I can drink a glass of water now without any fears of choking. And you don't know how good a glass of water tastes until you can't have one.
Yes, someone I know that had a stroke who had a similar situation said it reminded them of being in constant recovery from major dental surgery where you're all numbed up and you just can't make it work the way it's supposed to.
That's a good description, yeah.
Yeah, which we all know how uncomfortable that is if we've had some kind of procedure. So, Sheree Porter, what do we do? Retrain muscles, retrain the brain. What do you do?
All of the above. It's troops to the surface, and everybody's out there working. And what Doug's describing is the medical term is dysphagia or dysphagia in the world of speech pathology. And he was having a difficulty with swallowing. We have all kinds of tricks and tools and to help patients regain that ability. For some people, it's a faster process. For some, it's not. I'm a speech pathologist. I've been in that position of telling someone, we're going to have to give you thickened water, thickened juices to drink for now. And this is the safest way for you to tolerate liquids because we don't want you to aspirate it into your lungs and then develop pneumonia, what's called aspiration pneumonia, and set yourself all the way back to square one. So it's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to hear. It's a hard thing to tell. But what we like to do is empower our survivors, our stroke survivors, into being peer visitors. And a peer visitor is someone who's gone through everything, and they're available to come to bedside or come to that patient and say, listen, like Doug just done, I had to do this for a month. It was terrible. It was awful. Hated it. But it wasn't the end of the world. I tolerated it well, and I've worked my way back. So there is that piece of it. Again, his attitude played big time into that. And then for occupational therapy will come in as well. And not in Doug's case, but for some of those patients who are having difficulty swallowing, they might also have difficulty feeding themselves. Just the act of getting their weak limb to hold a spoon and bring it to their mouth. Occupational therapy will work with them for that. And then the physical therapy piece of things is looking at strength and endurance. The overall goal of all of rehabilitation is safety first and independence followed right after that.
Okay. And Von Knight, that component there of having folks to come by and say, I know what you're going through. I went through it too. You can work with this. You can get over this. That sounds like that's really important.
Absolutely. You know, when patients have had a stroke, they've had a major devastating event. And not only is it a lot of psychosocial experiences for the patient, but it's the family. And like I said, the families are devastated. And a key role of mine being on the acute stroke team is meeting with the patients, meeting with the family, listening, providing support, providing encouragement to say things will get better and you will be a stroke survivor. So a lot of it is so much with the psychosocial component of it.
Yeah, and having that family support is another really critical part of the equation. By the way, if you're just joining us, this is Perspectives on WFSU-FM, and we are talking about strokes today. There's also a big event coming up that we want to tell you about now, and we'll repeat it again before the end of the hour that is coming up at Tallahassee Memorial. Let's see, a week from today. How about that? Well, you can mark your calendar, Thursday, May 6th. And Sheree Porter, what's going on with that?
Well, it's on the 16th, and it's an all-day, well, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the hospital atrium. We're doing free stroke screenings. Physicians will be on hand. We're doing cholesterol checks, blood pressure checks, education. One of the things that we're going to be doing is showing a movie. The movie is called Aphasia, the movie. It's a 40-minute film, and it is starring and produced by an individual who experienced a stroke himself. It's a great movie. We'll be showing that a couple times, I believe, at 11 and 1. We'll also have people from our diabetes center out there, pharmacists, and at the end of the event, you're able to sit down with a physician and review all your results from the day.
Wow. So and free?
Free. Totally free.
Okay, and this is in the atrium, which is right off of the main parking garage at Tallahassee Memorial Hospital. Come on in. That will be a week from today, Thursday, May 16th, from 9 until 2. Back to the phones we go. Barbara joins us now in Perspective. Hey, Barbara.
Yes, I have a question. I'm just curious if there is any research going on in, as far as using stem cells for stroke victims.
Oh, that's an intriguing question. Dr. Sagal, anything happening there?
Actually, there is. Thank you for that question, Barbara. There is a research trial that was just started about a year and a half ago, which is looking at the exact question that you asked about stem cell injections to patients who have just had a stroke, who cannot get the clot-busting medicine for whatever reason, and to see if they have a better outcome or a better recovery than people who do not get that stem cell. We have some preliminary data from heart attacks, and that showed that it was not harmful. That's all that we know so far. So, yes, there is some research going on about stem cells in acute strokes.
Okay, because the conventional wisdom, as I recall, used to be when a brain cell died or there was even damage to a neuron in your arm or any place else, that was the end of the line. It couldn't grow back. It couldn't regenerate. It was dead.
That still holds true. It really depends on how much the extent of the injury is to that neuron, what kind of injury there was. But these stem cells, what they do is they help regenerate neurons by making new neurons because those stem cells can form any type of cell in the body that they want.
Okay. Yeah, they are the all-purpose, sort of the Swiss Army knife of cells.
Exactly.
They can be anything.
Yes.
So that's some research going on here with strokes. You have a question about stroke. You have an experience with stroke, either yourself or someone you know. Give us a call, 414-1234, 800-926-8809, and perspectives at WFSU.org. We'll be right back. Due to medical advances, particularly in recent years, stroke now the number 4 killer. Used to be number 3. And that's, you learn something new every day. That's what I love about this program. Perspectives, what you're listening to on WFSU-FM, 414-1234, 800-926-8809 for your calls, emails, perspectives at WFSU.org. Well, we were picking up with a thread, Dr. Sagal, on this some of the new research and everything else about strokes. That's great, but there still seems to be some parts of the country that are more susceptible for folks to have strokes than others. And I understand, Sheree Porter, from previous discussions we've had, we're one of them. Why?
Absolutely. So we are we live in a place which is sort of part of the area which is called the stroke belt of the country, and the main reason for that is the diet. There was just recently at the International Stroke Conference in February of this year, there was some research that was presented which showed that the southern diet is associated with a significantly high risk of stroke as compared to all other diets that we have in this country. And this stroke belt has the highest incidence of strokes in the whole country, and predominantly that is because of the diet. And there was just another research that was published just 2 weeks ago, which showed that if you spend your teenage years in the stroke belt as compared to spending any other part of your life in the stroke belt, you would be at a higher risk. And it's probably because teenagers are the most susceptible to the kind of diet that we have nowadays.
Okay, so we're talking high fat and high
Absolutely.
Calorie and all?
High fat, high calorie, and the fried chickens, the fried foods, red meat. That is the biggest problem with the diet, and that would cause a stroke.
Okay. Now, Doug Wright, when it comes to diet here, again, you are a slim, good-looking guy here, so obviously, you know, obesity is not one of the risk factors here that you deal with. What's your typical diet like right now since you've had your stroke?
Well, I don't think there's anything typical about it. I'm still working, so you know, go to a different place for lunch every day. I generally eat a very light breakfast, typically a bagel or a bowl of Cheerios with banana on it for breakfast. Lunch, probably the most common thing I eat at lunch is a tuna fish sandwich. And then supper, my wife's very good about trying to keep low fats, making sure I get good vegetables. So I eat a pretty good variety of food, very tasty food, but I try to limit my intake of fat.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be the sticks and berries kind of, tofu kind of thing.
No, I don't live on sticks and berries.
I can tell. Well, you said you originally hailed from Memphis, and you've been here about a quarter of a century. So as a Southerner, and boy, we still love our fried stuff, but you just got to – moderation, huh?
Right. But, that there has to be more to it than that. I'm 72 years old. My mother is 97 years old, still living, and she still fries pretty much everything she eats, puts a little strip of bacon in just about every pot of vegetables she cooks, and she's still here. And my dad died at 95 2 years ago, so there's got to be more to it than just diet, I think, because they have certainly eaten the Southern diet their entire lives. And
yeah, but they had a
pretty ripe age.
They probably had a different lifestyle, I imagine, when they were in their formative years, their teens, their 20s and everything, because there was much more physical labor involved with just about every job back then than there was now. So maybe when they were, as you said, Dr. Sagal, during their teenage years, they were kind of working it off.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe. So it's not just a diet. It's about how much of that diet are you burning when you doing physical activity?
Yeah, it was certainly different then. We just got an email. A person doesn't want her name used. She says her husband recently displayed slurred speech and numbness in both hands, but was told he did not have a stroke. Rather, he had TIA. And she wants to know, what's the difference between TIA and strokes?
That's a really good question. The main difference, so TIA stands for transient ischemic attack, and that really means that the stroke symptoms were transient and went away on their own without needing any treatment. And usually TIA symptoms would last up to about 1 hour. The textbook definition is up to 24 hours. So if the symptoms resolve on their own, that's what a TIA is. But in terms of risk factor management and everything else that we do, there is no difference between a stroke and a TIA. We would still handle that TIA patient the same way that we would a stroke patient. The only difference is that the TIA patient may not need to get the clot-busting medicine in the emergency room, but the risk factors are exactly the same. And a patient who has had a TIA is at a very, very high risk of having a stroke within the next few days if we don't manage the risk factors as to what was causing that TIA in the first place.
Now, this is a red flag then, huh?
Absolutely. You cannot take it lightly. You have to get those patients in the emergency room, evaluate them just like you would a stroke patient.
Oh, okay. Sheree Porter, on the rehabilitative side again, have you seen any, I guess, changes, improvements in the way that the therapies, recovery therapies are today vis-a-vis many years ago, perhaps?
Oh, yes. Our average length of stay is around 28 days, I'd say, for the average stroke survivor. So the length of stay, I would say, is similar, but we have more and more options with the addition of technology and knowledge, just as we're out there teaching prevention. We're learning it, as we go along. My favorite place to learn about stroke is from stroke survivors, telling us what's working and not working for them. It's very empowering for them and for us as therapists as well. A regimen for stroke rehabilitation, we're seeing patients coming to the rehab center about 3 days after experiencing their stroke, being there for another, let's say, 3 to 4 weeks, then going to an outpatient continuum. We have advances in the technology for dysphagia. What Doug was talking about, we now are able to provide what we call neuromuscular electrical stimulation. And in the past, let's say 15, 20 years ago, we were providing exercises that patients would have to perform. And it's pretty hard to work out your throat, your larynx. But now we can actually apply electrical stimulation, which can promote the improvement of your swallow quicker.
Okay, and that's, again, firing those neurons and kind of getting them back
used. Overriding the system.
Yeah, or rewiring. You described it to me once.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good. Vaughn Knight, back to the family here. How can families help folks, either stroke victims or to help them to keep from becoming stroke victims in the first place? How can I help mom, dad, you know, my wife, all this sort of thing?
Family is a really big, important part of it. And usually when patients are coming in, sometimes it's not the patient that I'm teaching. It really is the family, because if I've had a stroke, it might have been a devastating stroke. And so I'm teaching the families how to, teaching them that patient's personal risk factors, teaching them things that they can do to prevent further stroke. So the education goes a long way, and the family is a big part of it, the support team. And so, like I said, when the patient has had a stroke, the family, everybody has been affected.
Yeah, because it's so, I guess, instinctive that you want to protect the person who has been sick from anything. So, you know, mom, you just stay in bed now. Don't you move around. I'll do everything for you. And really, mom should be up moving.
Trying to be as independent as possible, exercising. And so the family really should be letting mom do all that mom can do.
Okay. And listening to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Martha's checking in with us on line one here on Perspectives. Hi, Martha. Hey, Martha.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a question about when a person having a stroke presents themselves to the emergency room. I know that most strokes are caused by clots, and if they administer the clot, you know, blocking medicine or whatever it's called early, you can help the patient a lot. But what happens if you administer that medicine and the hemorrhagic stroke?
Martha, that's a really good question. That medicine cannot be given to people who had a hemorrhagic stroke. And actually, before we give that medicine, it's called TPA. And the medicine we can only give to people who have had a CAT scan in the emergency room, and that scan does not show any evidence of bleeding in the brain. If there is bleeding, we cannot give this medicine because it's a clot buster and it will actually cause more bleeding in the brain. So for the hemorrhagic strokes, there is no medicine that those patients will receive as soon as they come to the hospital. But the main goal would be to stabilize them, and some of those patients may need surgical evacuation of that blood if it is causing a whole lot of pressure onto the rest of the normal brain. And then the next goal would be to find out why that happened and how can we prevent it from happening again.
Is there a ratio of bleeding strokes to clot strokes, doctor?
So about 70 to 75% of all strokes are the ischemic strokes, which is the blockage stroke, and about 20 to 25% are the hemorrhagic strokes, which is where you have bleeding in the brain, and a small percentage are what's called the subarachnoid hemorrhage, which are due to aneurysms.
Okay. Are those more dangerous than the ischemic or the clotting stroke?
In terms of mortality, yes. About one-third of all people with an aneurysmal bleed in the brain will die before getting to the hospital. And another one-third or 20% would die either in the hospital or in the next 30 days from when that happened.
Yeah, but the quicker you get there, the better your chances regardless.
Regardless of the type of stroke, the quicker you get to the hospital, the better chances of you recovering from that or the lower chances of dying from that.
Okay, just a few moments we have left here. Well, Doug Wright, what's ahead for you? How do you see all this playing out as far as you're concerned? Just day by day or what?
Well, I am very close right now to, as I said, being where I was before I had the stroke. As far as my activities, I'm able to work. I'm working about the same level I was working before. I'm still doing my own yard work. I still have plans to do some adventure trips with my grandchildren. I refuse to let this significantly alter my lifestyle, and I see no reason why I won't be able to do that. As I said, I still have some residual effects, but in the overall scheme of things compared to what it could be, I feel very blessed that I only have these small issues, and they don't really affect my lifestyle at all. So I would encourage anybody that's had a stroke, just stick with the physical therapy, do what the therapists tell you to do, and even when they release you from therapy, typically they'll give you some exercises to continue on your own and some tips to strengthen the weak parts of your body, and follow through with that and you'll get back.
Well, we're rooting for you, Doug. We really are. And Sheree Porter, more of a typical story now than used to be.
More and more and more. Early in my career, you didn't see this as much. But again, it's through the empowerment of education, the advances in medication, technology, information. I think we can't ignore information overload. It can be sometimes on the World Wide Web. But really, people are more educated now about stroke. And living here in the stroke belt, you're more likely to know someone who's had a stroke. You're more likely to be related to someone or have been around someone with that experience. And I think that's just giving us more information to know how to go forward.
Mm-hmm. And even if Von Knight, they can't look you up over TMH, there's still a lot of good sources of information that people can pull down and avoid some of the urban myths that are out there about, you know, magical herbs and that kind of thing that can prevent stroke and heart disease and cancer and all that kind of stuff, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so where do we find that good information if folks want to go and check it out?
There's TMH does have a website, and also there's a lot of information out there. Just Googling stroke, they can go to the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, and I would highly recommend going to the American Heart Association and American Stroke Association because it keeps the most up-to-date current information about stroke.
And if you want to find out some more stuff locally, again, Sheree, let's have a plug for what's coming up next Thursday.
Well, on next Thursday, a week from today, May the 16th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., Tallahassee Memorial, through our Neuroscience Center, we will be hosting a free stroke screening event open to anyone in the public. Anybody who lives in this area really should come and take advantage. Blood pressure checks, cholesterol checks, blood sugar. We'll have physical therapists there to test balance. We'll have pharmacists there to look at your – if you bring a list of your medications, they can review that. People from our Diabetes and Heart Institute will be there for education. Physicians will sit down with you at the end of the event and review all of your numbers and talk to you about your personal risk. Therapists will be there to do stroke risk assessments. And we will also be doing stroke simulations if you'd like to – get an idea of what it would be like to experience those symptoms.
Oh, you mean I got to get on an elliptical machine and work out and then, you know, have the same situation that that Doug had? No.
Okay.
You're not saying that, right?
No, but we can let you walk through in the shoes and see through the eyes of someone that may have had a stroke.
Okay, and we will also reemphasize the fact, as you urged us to do, Doug, that it is not exercise that causes strokes. In fact, it may be one of your best preventions for having a stroke and certainly one of your best ways for a rapid recovery.
Then. Right, I agree.
Okay. Well, that's and I see Dr. Sagal nodding his head, too. So that's very important. Just watch the diet and just the regular stuff that keeps us healthy, it sounds
absolutely.
Like.
It's all common sense things, which sometimes is not very common. And I think if you go onto the American Stroke Association website, the latest data suggests that if you do 30 minutes of good physical exercise every day, that is your best tool to both prevent a stroke as well as prevent age-related memory decline, which again is the other aspect of people who keep having multiple strokes. With age, they develop memory problems that could be prevented with exercise. And diet is you know, low in fat, low in cholesterol, low in red meat, and high in fruits, vegetables, and white meat.
I can see another program on the horizon right now. We can talk about all these things in even greater detail. It has been an absolute honor and a thrill to have all of you here on Perspectives to talk about how to not only treat strokes, but also how to prevent them. And again, that's free stroke screening, a comprehensive thing coming up at the Atrium at Tallahassee Memorial Healthcare, a week from today, Thursday, May 16th, 9 until 2. Dr. Segal, Sheree Porter, Vaughn Knight, and Doug Wright, thank you so much for coming on today on Perspectives.
Thank you, Tom.
Appreciate the information, folks. Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Technical assistance by Taylor Cox. Lydell Rawls back there on the phones and emails and tweets today. I'm Tom Flanagan. Hope you can join us for Perspectives next week. We'll be delving into the question, is there hope for the hungry? And we hope that's healthy food, too. We'll see you then.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.